talking about the effects of alcohol that would occur and interfere with your sex life, no matter who your sexual partner was or where they are. This type of sexual dysfunction may or may not involve all of your sex partners, this has got to do with how intimate you are. I think that it's worthwhile talking about intimacy, though, in the first place, because intimacy has got to do with what I talked about a while ago. If you have, you've got to have a strong sex drive, or you have to have a sex drive, a symbiotic drive, and you have to have a drive for self-preservation, separation drive. And if you've got the right proportion to those two drives, they will come together, and you will have the ability to be intimate with someone. And intimacy, of course, is what alcoholics are very shy on, and we all know that an alcoholic can be lonely in a crowd, and he can live with somebody for years and never have any intimate feelings. Some of this is on a cultural basis, and there's certainly a difference between men and women when it comes to this. Women have a tendency to turn themselves off when it comes to sex, and men have a tendency to turn themselves on when it comes to sex. Now, if you went to Masters and Johnson down there, or if you have much knowledge about sex, you have discovered something in recent years that Masters and Johnson wrote about a few years ago, and that's that women are probably 20 times more sexual than men are. Since the discovery of the multiple orgasms and so forth, we now know that women are much more sexual than men. Men don't like to admit that, perhaps, but the fact, those are the facts. Now, what has women and what have men done about this discrepancy? Well, the women have been raised to believe that they're not supposed to be as sexual as men. As a matter of fact, Queen Victoria, on the wedding night of her daughters, would tell them, my dear, she said, just close your eyes and think of England. I mean, they weren't women thought they were not supposed to enjoy sex, and so they had this 20 times more potent sex drive than men, and so what did they do? But they turned themselves off. And if the women didn't do that because of the influences of the culture, the mothers made sure they did because they didn't want their daughters to get pregnant, they would make them have fear of pregnancy or fear of disease and all those things, and that would turn the girls off, and they would therefore preserve their virginity. On the other hand, males were taught to be masculine, to break away from their mothers. They weren't supposed to be emotional. They weren't supposed to cry. They weren't supposed to show their emotions, but they were supposed to be proud of their sexuality. A boy couldn't be 3 years old without knowing about his penis and be proud of it and so forth. Nature cooperated with mothers in this situation because, you know, sex organs have three parts, right? They have a sensual part, a reproductive part, and an excretory part. And in boys, they all those three functions all come together in one place, the penis. It's a very sensual organ, and at 3 years of age, as I said, every boy knows about it, and they know he gets enjoyment from it, and he is not ashamed of it, and so forth. Nature has hidden away, has made those three organs, the excretory, the sensual, and the reproductive, they put those in the woman's body to end in three different places, completely separate from one another, and they've hidden them away inside so the girl can live to be 25 years old and not even know they're there. And this is literally and seriously the truth. And with her turnoffs, then she becomes ashamed of her sex life. And as opposed to the boy who is very proud of her sex life, and she is taught to turn herself off. Now, Nancy Friday, in her book My Mother and Myself, I think explains this as beautiful as anybody has ever done it, and I highly recommend that book. She said that women become ashamed of their sexuality, where men become proud of their sexuality. And she said, for instance, women have to whisper and hush-hush about their periods and all that. She said, if men had periods, men would find some way to brag about it. And I can see it now at some smoker some night. You know, the men are sitting around a table and some guy starts having his period. he would stand up and say, "Wow, I'm having a spontaneous emission." And that would start a topic of conversation. "You only used 3 pads last month. I used 12 pads. So if you stop and think about women going through this and learning to turn themselves off like they have to do, it's not surprising then that men have their sexual maturity at a younger age of, say, 17, because they indeed, by our cultures, have been encouraged to turn themselves on, and women have been encouraged to turn themselves off, and they catch up with each other just about age 35, and it works out pretty good, where this is mostly cultural. People have thought, you know, there must be a mismatch here between men and women. I don't think it's a mismatch at all. It's simply that women have been taught to successfully turn themselves on, off, and women and men have been successfully taught to turn themselves on. This brings up the whole subject then of fantasies, because fantasy is the way you would resolve this problem. And fantasies, of course, are usually ridiculed by, especially by women. Now, we have a guilt towards fantasy dating back to childhood, because at 4 years old, the child cannot tell the difference between wishes and reality, and so he has ideas that he'd like to kill his parents sometime, or he hates them, and he wishes some things, and sometimes those things happen. So he or she has a guilt about fantasy. Furthermore, religions have come along, and made fantasy, but they call it temptation, and they have made this bad. So a lot of people have hang-ups against fantasies or calling temptations, and they are afraid to use them. And I think fantasies are absolutely human and necessary for monogamy to survive. Now, if you stop and think about it, males are naturally polygamous. And when I say that, I'm not talking about human males, I'm talking about the animal male, because what is the animal male? How can he reproduce more of his own kind? He can reproduce more of his own kind by having multiple sex partners, right? If a male animal has 20 sex partners, he will reproduce 20 of himself in a year, and so that's biologically programmed to do that. A female animal, for instance, no matter how many male partners she may have, she will only reproduce one of her kind each year. So there's a natural inclination then for men to have multiple sex partners, where the woman is programmed to have only one, but she wants the best one that she can get. She wants the handsomest, the smartest, the best looking, the hardest working. She wants the very best. Now, fantasy is a way for both men and women to satisfy that natural desire. The man can fantasize multiple sex partners. The woman can fantasize the greatest sex partner, and therefore both of them can be satisfied with monogamy, and they can make their sex lives worse. For instance, there's the Coolidge phenomena Donald Simmons described in The Evolution of Human Sexuality. He called the Coolidge phenomena, goes like this. The President Coolidge and his wife went to a chicken farm one day, and they were visiting the chicken farm, and the president's wife noticed that the roosters was having sex with the hens, and she said to the chicken farmer, "Does the rooster have sex just once a day?" And the chicken farmer says, "Oh, heavens no." He says, "The roosters have sex 20 times a day." And she says, "Will you tell President Coolidge that?" So he goes over and he talks to President Coolidge, and he says, "Your wife wants you to know that the roosters have sex 20 times a day." And President Coolidge says, "With the same hen?" And the chicken farmer says, "Heavens, no, with 20 different hens." And he says, "Well, you go tell them this is Coolie's gut." That's the natural inclination. And in order for monogamy to occur, fantasy is a gift of God, if you will, to the human being, because it allows the man to satisfy that biological urge to have multiple sex partners by being happy in a monogamous situation, and it allows the female to have the strongest, best-looking, Robert Redford, you have it, partner, while she remains happy in a monogamous situation. So fantasies, then, are a way of overcoming these cultural turn-ons and turn-offs that have been instilled in us by our parents and so forth. Okay, there's also some another type of intimacy problem, and that's with adjustment reactions. I mean, I've heard a few remarks about adjustment reactions, and certainly because of the alcohol situation, people grow further and further apart. Now, you stop and look at the basic tendency of human beings. We start out with our relationships with rituals, then we go to pastimes, then we go to play, and then we go to intimacy. And what happens when something interferes with that is we start playing games, because if we get hurt on the way, if we have a lot of arguments and fights and problems with our marriage, instead of going on to intimacy, we start playing games, because games are a way of avoiding intimacy. And we need to avoid intimacy to avoid vulnerability. Now, intimacy is probably necessary for human beings to survive. We know, for instance, that if you take a child and put him in an orphanage at 1 month of age, he actually becomes mentally retarded because he doesn't get any intimacy. That's why they closed all the orphanages. Well, we also know that God gave man and woman five opportunities to become intimate in their lifetime. They first of all had a chance to be intimate with their mother during the symbiotic relationship of infancy. They had a chance to become intimate with their sex partner, and that's what the surrender of virginity is all about, that instant intimacy you get with sex. I think God invented sex in order for human beings to be intimate, because intimacy is necessary for our development. If we missed it in the first two chances, we get a second opportunity when we have missed one, the chum. And before we get intimate with our sex partner, we can become intimate with our chum. Chum relationships are exceedingly important in teenagers. Then with our spouse, then with our children, and then with our grandchildren. And I think alcoholics and Al-Anon people are especially important, are lucky, because they have a chance to be intimate without vulnerability in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and AA meetings. I've always, from my first meeting, I knew that as soon as I walked in the door, there was instant intimacy there without vulnerability. And AA works in multiple different ways, and I could spend the whole afternoon discussing how that is, but one of the ways it works is by giving you a chance to learn to be intimate again without vulnerability. And once you get a chance to be intimate again, then eventually you can take a chance and be vulnerable and get a relationship going. I forgot to look at what time we started. What time are we supposed to finish?
3:45.
Okay. The intimacy of alcoholic marriages depends on what kind of a relationship you have. And let me describe the three types of alcoholics that I think there are. We've heard about the gamma alcoholic and the delta alcoholic. I basically think there are three types of alcoholics. There's a born to succeed alcoholic, there's a born to win alcoholic, and there's a born to lose alcoholic. The born to succeed alcoholic is a man or woman who has guilt and goals. The born to win alcoholic has no guilt but lots of goals. And the born to lose alcoholic has no goals and no guilt. Be born to succeed alcoholic is the workaholic, the guy who's has two jobs, he's guilty about his drinking, and he always marries a little orphan Annie, someone who cannot cry because he needs somebody who doesn't need to depend on him for emotions, but he can. But they depends on him for his finances, like Daddy Warbucks, right? And if that born to succeed alcoholic a person becomes an alcoholic, then that little orphan Annie becomes a blamer or an enabler. Now, the born to win alcoholic, the one who has no guilt, he's the hail fellow, well met, belly up to the bar sort of a guy. The typical CIA, Catholic Irish and alcoholic, he's happy-go-lucky. He just loves to drink, and he doesn't understand why everybody isn't doing it, and he's married to Cinderella, because they live in a magic world, and they're just waiting for their ship to come in, and they take a lot of chances. The born to lose alcoholic, and that person always is an enabler also, and then we have the born to lose alcoholic who is married to Snow White in the Seven Snow White and Snow. he's a loser, if you will, and she's willing to change him. And if she can't change him, she'll exchange him for one of the other seven little defective people that she can marry, and go on marrying one right after the other until she thinks she can overcome this. Now, the whole secret to all of these is they all think they can overcome it. The first one by blaming the man, making him change. The second one by enabling the man, waiting for the magical, mysterious change to occur. And the last one by controlling the little defective person. But all of these games actually bring those people further and further and further apart. The games alcoholics play, if you read Claude Steiner, consist of three basic types of games: first degree games, second degree games, and third degree games. The first degree games are cops and robbers, or look what you made me do, or look how hard I've tried. The second degree games, we've heard a lot about them and at this meeting, they're murder, or who wears the pants in this family, or somebody needs a new baby, or I need a new baby, or we'll stick together for the sake of the children. I mean, that's a good one. That's a second-degree game that avoids a lot of intimacy, avoids a lot of vulnerability, and puts on a false front. Third-degree games are drunk and proud of it, lush or lady, and you can overcome that vulnerability through AA meetings. Supposing it's the female who is an alcoholic, what happens in this situation? Well, let's see what happens in this situation. What are females looking for when they get married? They've all been raised to believe that someday some man will come and kiss her on the cheek and she will live happily ever after, right? This is called someday my prince will come theory. No pun intended. Someday, some guy is going to come and kiss her on the cheek, and she will live happily ever after. And that's okay, but what happens if that female is an alcoholic, and that way she is prone to believe that everything that happens is his fault, the prince's fault, you see, because that's the way she was raised. If I'm not happy, it's because of him. And that is okay if you're not an alcoholic, but if you're an alcoholic, that's denial. Because you're saying then that your problem is not your booze or your pills, but it's his fault. And when you think you've got a problem that is caused by somebody else, there's only two things you can do about it. Number one, you can go out and look for another prince. That's a barfly, and that's what Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs does. She gets one look, exchange one little defective man for another little defective man. So you go out and look for another prince. That's what 10% of them do. 90% of them become depressed. And that's what happens to most female alcoholics. Depression is very common in both males and female alcoholics, but 60% of all the suicides performed in this country are performed by males, but 60% of all the suicides by alcoholics are performed by females. So more alcoholic females are committing suicide than alcoholic males, yet according to Dr. Goodwin this morning, I agree with him, the males still outnumber the females 5-1. So this is a horrendous problem as far as females with the depression, because they indeed think they have a problem that nobody can fix, and therefore they go out and try to either get another prince or become very depressed and commit suicide. Now, the way to overcome these, of course, is to use this dysfunction is to use that fantasy that I mentioned, and to overcome the differences between males and females as far as performance and pleasure. Males emphasize sex as far as performance is concerned. Females emphasize relationships as far as intimacy is concerned. Now, what we have to do is, of course, make the females a little, give them an edge on performance, and make the males more prone to have intimacy. And that's what Masters and Johnson's technique of sensate focus does. It takes the emphasis off of performance and puts it on to pleasure. It simply teaches the person that if you have a relationship for pleasurable purposes, then performances will happen. And then of course it teaches the female that she does not have to be ashamed of her sexuality, and that makes her performance better, and the two together work very well. Actually, the best way to overcome intimacy problems is to form a perfect marriage. And a perfect marriage is defined by Peter Martin as two people who are equally independent, mutually dependent, with reciprocal obligations. And when Peter Martin drew that picture on a board at a seminar I was at, I said, my God, no wonder AA works so well. That's exactly the way AA works. AA is the alcoholic goes to his meetings, stands on his own 2 feet, grows tall and straight. The Al-Anon member goes to his or her own meeting, stands on his or her own 2 feet and grow tall and straight, and the two together make something greater, a whole greater than either one standing alone. So it's not surprising then that AA is an ideal situation for overcoming sexual dysfunction problems. I might say that that same scheme up there is a description of women's lib, and women's lib is God's gift to women. God's gift to men, as far as a sexually dysfunctional man is concerned, because it takes the responsibility off of him to perform. Remember that a lot of men become impotent because they have a fear of performance. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Women's lib is saying you are not responsible for our lives, including our sex lives. Reminds me of the two people who met in the bar and they wanted to know each other better, so they go across the street to the motel, and she takes off all her clothes and he takes off all his clothes, and he gets his clothes all off, and she looks down at him, and he's not endowed too well in the sex department, you know. She looks at him really disappointed, and she says, "My," she said, "who do you expect to satisfy with that?" He looks at her completely undaunted, and he said, "Me." So this is what the sensate focus of Masters and Johnson's is all about. It puts the emphasis on pleasure and not on performance, and that makes the female more prone through fantasy and learning how to perform sexually, having her increase her performance, and having the male decrease his performance and put more emphasis on pleasure. Next category I want to talk about is disorders of self-esteem. And disorders of self-esteem are divided into anxiety disorders and situational anxiety. Anxiety disorders are actually internal anxiety. You know, Dr. Goodlow talked about the stimulus augmenters, and I think that's exactly the correct. And alcoholics do have increased anxiety, and they learn that alcohol decreases that and makes them feel more normal, and they get so they can depend on that. But let's see what that does as far as our sex life is concerned. For instance, if a man or a woman has a desire to have sex, he feels that as an increase in tension, right? If I want to have sex and I'm deprived for a short while or whatever, I feel increased in tension. That tension goes on until I have sex, and then the tension in my body goes down. Now, what happens if I'm an alcoholic and I become addicted to alcohol? I have a desire to have sex. How does my, have a drink, I mean, how does my body feel that? My body feels that as an increase in tension. I want to have a drink, I'm more tense. That tension goes on until I drink, and then the tension goes down. You might say, the human body, you know, can't tell the difference very well between a drop in tension from having sex or a drop in tension from having a drink. It also can't tell the difference very well from the tension from a desire for a drink and the tension from a desire to have sex. You might say that poor person doesn't know whether he's horny or thirsty at a time like that. But eventually, of course, the next morning, he's raring to go. And a lot of binge drinkers will tell you that. And even alcoholics in their early drinking years will say, well, it's true that that alcohol satisfied my sexual tension the night before. But the next night, I was really raring to go. And that's true until some of these other things that I talked about start setting in. And then, of course, the ability to perform is not there either the night before or the next morning. The other thing that occurs as far as anxiety is concerned is fear. And fear, especially fear of or low self-esteem or fear of performance. Masters and Johnson described the fear of performance thing. And they said that fear of performance varies all the way from frustration to panic. And if you want to know what frustration is, it's the first time you can't do it the second time. Panic is the second time you can't do it the first time. This is called fear of performance. And it goes like this. It's a real thing. You know, it's an anxiety thing. Got to do with that stimulus augmenters. If I'm walking down a dark alley in the middle of the nighttime, all by myself, and somebody jumps out at me and says boo and scares me, what happens is my adrenal gland puts out adrenaline, so I start shaking, and I got the energy then to fight like hell or run. Well, the same thing occurs, of course, in the situation where you have an opportunity to have sex and you fail. The next time you have an opportunity to have sex and you fail the third time, you got that anxiety, and you wouldn't be able to perform under any circumstances. And if you don't believe that, imagine yourself walking down the dark alley in the middle of the nighttime all alone sometime, and somebody jumping out at you and saying, boo, I want to know if you're going to stop and have sex any time like that. I can assure you it would be the furthest thing from your mind and ability, and this mad cat here illustrates that, because that cat is mad and angry and scared, and everything is standing up on him except the things necessary in order to have sex. Getting back to the situational anxieties, actually we have, let's talk about self-preservation. If you have, let's go on to the situational anxieties. Situational anxieties have got to do with shame, guilt, or loss of self-esteem. And the loss of self-esteem, I can see that, you can see how that readily happens if that depends on your status. For males especially, because a lot of males, their job and so forth means status. And if a male has an image of himself of what it is to be a male, usually involves having a job, having a family, disciplining the kids, wife staying home, not working, taking care of the kids, and all. That's his image of a male, and that's fine. Supposing he becomes an alcoholic, and he loses his job, his wife goes out to work, the kids won't be disciplined by him because they have no respect for him, he loses his status, and therefore he loses his gender or role identification. This can end up in him having not only low self-esteem, but he isn't really sure he's a male. When I was in medical school 20-plus years ago, the psychiatrists all thought that, by definition, alcoholics were either latent or overt homosexuals.
Excuse me, Dick. We have a Very important call.
Okay.
Is there a Tony Susanello in the audience?
Tony Susanello?
Something very... there's a call they're holding for you. Upstairs. Very important.
Okay. Hmm? Yeah, I'm just weighing up right now. Okay, the psychiatrist thought that all alcoholics were homosexual, and of course there was reason to believe that because after all they sort of acted like homosexuals. They spent a lot of time with the people of the same sex, they were unable to perform sexually, and they were hostile towards the opposite sex. Now, of course, we know that this is not the case, but that they may be experimenting homosexually in order to they may either be using homosexuality as an opportunistic experience, or they may be using homosexuality because they are so inadequate, or it may be situational, where they're in jail or so forth. They may have an avoidance homosexuality because they're avoiding the same sex or the opposite sex, or it might be intermittent homosexuality, or it might be experimental. Okay, in closing, I think only one more thing that I wanted to talk about, and that's that during whenever you get the phobias and fear of the opposite sex and low self-esteem, a lot of people respond to that by avoidance, one of the best ways of avoiding a intimate partner is having affairs. And alcoholics have affairs not to increase relationships a lot of time, but they have affairs to raise their own self-esteem or lower the self-esteem of somebody else. And if you can have an affair to raise your own self-esteem, it can be an attempt to get autonomy, to get your sex life revived, to prove that you're not inadequate, to overcome frustrations of sexual deprivation, or to even it up. You can have affairs to overcome sexual dysfunction by trying to experiment, by novelty, by inadequacy, or even by homosexuality. You can have affairs to lower the self-esteem of the other people, and they are infidelity, jealousy affairs, manipulative affairs, or revenge affairs. Hastening along to the affairs to avoid intimacy, they are indeed avoidance affairs, performance affairs, or combative affairs, but most of those affairs, all of those affairs should be avoided because they all end up in escalating affairs, which usually decrease any intimacy that you may be seeking or after. There's also the accidental affairs that I call coyote affairs, and they only happen to alcoholics, and a coyote affair happens in a blackout. I don't know if you ever heard about them or not, but during a blackout, some guys end up in a hotel room not remembering a thing they did the night before, to wake up the next morning with some dog in his arm. He doesn't know her name or how he got there, but he feels like chewing off his arm and sneaking out of the room before she wakes up. Okay, I'm sorry to have rushed through the last part of that. The timing was not off, but the message, of course, is that alcohol and alcoholism causes a lot of sexual dysfunction problems in multiple different ways. Sum and substance, however, is that the vast majority of those types of sexual dysfunctions disappear by stopping drinking, going to AA meetings, and overcoming the intimacy problems through the AA program. Thank you.